Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this Science Media Centre background briefing on the use of forensic DNA. This year marks the 20th anniversary of DNA evidence being presented in court and resulting in a conviction in New Zealand. But DNA was used in Britain much earlier, as early as 1986, to secure a conviction in a criminal case, thanks in large part to the work of our guest speaker today. We have two speakers, actually, today who will speak and present slides. After the presentations, we'll open things up for Q&A questions. So let me introduce our speakers. Dr. Peter Gill formerly worked at the UK's Forensic Science Service between 1982 and 2008. He began research into DNA in 1985, collaborating with Sir Alec Jeffries of Leicester University. In the same year, they published the first demonstration of the forensic application of DNA profiling. Now, that research led to the first major DNA breakthrough in a criminal investigation the following year. In this case, it was a double murder investigation in a small Leicestershire town. In 1989, he was awarded under the Civil Service Inventor Scheme for his discovery of the preferential sperm DNA extraction technique and the development of associated forensic tests. In 1993-94, he was responsible for leading the team which confirmed the identity of the remains of the Romanov family, murdered in 1918, and also the subsequent investigation which disproved the claim of Anna Anderson to be the Duchess Anastasia. And now his current roles are Senior Lecturer at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, and Professor of Legal Medicine at the University of Oslo in Norway. Our second speaker is from New Zealand. Dr. Sally Ann Harbison is currently the Science and Technology Leader of the Forensic Biology Group of Environmental Science and Research, the Crown Research Institute, contracted by the New Zealand Police to undertake forensic work. She has been carrying out forensic DNA and crime scene work since 1988. At ESR, she manages the technical operation of the forensics group. She also advises forensic laboratories across Asia and is an honorary lecturer at the University of Auckland. And Sally Ann's research interests are currently the development of gene expression tools for the detection of bodily fluids in crime scene samples, the development of plant material as forensic evidence, and the population genetics of Polynesia, particularly the Y chromosome. So I'll hand over now to Dr. Gill to begin.
Okay, thank you very much. The title of my talk is Science, Law, Policymakers, an Evolving Relationship. And what I want to do is really to go through what I like to call the four eras of DNA testing. And as we've just heard, the DNA period started in 1985, and that's when the first tests were developed. In 1995, the first UK National DNA Database started up. In the year 2000, the systems that we used became much more powerful to discriminate between individuals, and that leads us up to the present day, 2010, where a lot of things are happening to exchange data across the EU countries, and again, we are seeing a huge increase in the discriminating power of systems which will be used. But if you go back to 1986, where we had the first case, and this involved the murder of two girls, 1983, Linda Mann, 1986, Dawn Ashworth. And these are called the Marlborough murders. What happened was that the police had identified a suspect called Richard Buckland, and he had confessed to the Dawn Ashworth murder, but he denied all knowledge of Linda Mann. Now, the police were convinced that they had their man, and they went to Alec Jeffries to ask him to carry out this new DNA profiling test, which he duly did. And much to their surprise, Alec Jeffries excluded him as a potential suspect. And this is the reason that I got involved with this case, and the reason is because the police were not happy with the results because they thought that there might be a problem with the test. But after I carried out the testing, we got exactly the same result. So the consequence was that the prime suspect was exonerated. The police were convinced that the perpetrator lived in the local area, and this ultimately led to the first mass screen of more than 5,000 males using blood grouping and DNA analysis. So it was an important point to make that the first case of DNA profiling was actually used to exonerate an individual. And not only that, that, but the very first case led to the first mass screen, and that provided proof in principle of the power of DNA profiling. And at the same time, the concept of the National DNA Database was born, because it demonstrated that DNA databases were actually a feasible option. So the UK DNA database now comprises more than 5 million profiles, and we have a population of 60 million people, so there's quite a significant proportion of the population on this database. And as I said, it began in 1995, and the system that we used has a discriminating power of 1 in 50 million, which means there's a 1 in 50 million chance of a random match with an unknown individual. This discriminating power wasn't actually sufficient as the database started to grow. Although this discriminating power sounds quite good, when you get up to very large databases, you find that you need more discriminating power. So for that reason, a new system was introduced. We simply add more markers to the existing system, and that provided us with a discriminating power of around about 1 in 1 billion. This system is used currently, but now new systems are going to be introduced to facilitate pan-European DNA database, because there is now EU policy to exchange data across European boundaries, and of course we have much, much larger populations to consider, and that means we need systems with even better discriminating power. Now, once the UK National DNA Database had been introduced, novel, unexpected applications arose, and one of these is called familial searching. And this involves actually finding a relative of a suspect, i.e. someone who isn't actually in the database. Now, in some jurisdictions, this has raised serious ethical issues, and so it's not possible to use this method in all jurisdictions. But it has proven to be a very powerful method to bring perpetrators to justice. And the first example is that of Craig Harmon. 19-year-old Craig Harmon and a friend were walking home one night, and they crossed the M3 motorway in Surrey using a bridge. He picked up a brick and he dropped it onto a passing lorry. The brick went straight through the windscreen and hit the driver on the chest and killed him. The brick was retrieved, and it was possible to analyse DNA from the brick, but when it was compared to the National DNA database, there was no match. So this was the first case in which this familial testing was carried out, and to carry out this test, we looked for near matches. And in this particular case, there was a match at 16 of the 20 regions tested to a person living in Surrey near to the bridge. Again, similar to the first case that was carried out, the police were convinced that the perpetrator lived locally. So what they did then was to compare these near matching profiles to people living in the vicinity. And these near matching profiles can indicate a close genetic relative. So the police then draw up a short list of people, and then various people are interviewed and asked if they've got relatives, and these relatives are then DNA profiled, and by this process Craig Harmon was identified and tested, and he exactly matched the DNA profile found on the brick. And he's subsequently pleaded guilty to manslaughter and is now serving 6 years in prison. Now let's turn to talk about significant recent events. And this involves the use of a method which is called low copy number, or low template DNA. It's proven to be a fairly controversial technique, and it was used in the Omar bombing, and I want to talk about that next, and I also want to talk about a couple of other appeal court decisions. Okay, so the low-copy number method was effectively invented in the year 2000, and this is the paper that started the test and describes all the procedures to be used. And then wants to turn straight to the Omar bombing. The Omar bombing was the worst atrocity on the Irish mainland. 29 people were killed, more than 200 were injured. The suspect, Sean Hurry, was accused of the bombing and various other atrocities. Yet his trial in 2007 led to his acquittal. Now I want to go through the issues around the acquittal and what to describe what happened subsequently. So at trial, the suspect, Sean Hurry, was found innocent, and the presiding judge, Judge Weir, criticised his low copy number. And following this criticism, the process immediately ceased and was subject to a review. And here's some examples of the press cuttings. Police suspend use of discredited DNA tests after Omar acquittal. CPS, that's the Crown Prosecution Service, to review other low copy number court cases. Expert claims authorities warned about problems. And that happened just before Christmas of the year 2007. 3 weeks later, after the Christmas break, after the review, police resume use of DNA method, but the internal review decided that the method was fit for purpose. And so the forensic authorities in the UK resumed use of the method and just carried on. At the same time, the Home Office instigated a review of low copy number, and this is known as the Caddy Report, and it's available online should you wish to read it. 3 months later, the report is published, and the DNA technique is again found fit for purpose. Had various other recommendations in there, which I won't go into, but the main point was it was found to be fit for purpose. At the same time, the Caddy report was criticised, primarily because of the conflicting findings of the Omar trial, which found that the technique was not valid, and that was obviously contrasted quite strongly with the findings of the Caddy report. Various adverse publications appear, various questions about whether it is a cover-up, etc. And here is just giving an example of one of the papers which appeared. 18 months later, we have to wait 18 months for the next appeal court ruling. And another challenge to low copy number before the appeal court, which is called the read and read appeal. And this appeal court ruling was held in London. We have the same defence expert as Omar, Professor Alan Jameson, who gave evidence. In addition, the former FBI senior scientist gave evidence. So what did the court decide in this appeal? Unusually for an appeal court, they talked about the Omar trial, and they said this: it's impossible to understand how he, referring to Alan Jameson, had sufficient expertise to be able to give evidence in R.V. Hurry, let alone to assist the attack made in that case on the LCN process. Court found that they had clear reservations about the extent of his expertise in relation to DNA profiles. And this is just an example of a press cutting. Doubt cast on Omar bomb forensic witness. One week ago, we have a view from a New York court on acceptance. The New York system uses a procedure which is known as the FRI hearing. The purpose of the FRI hearing is to discover whether a technique is scientifically sound or generally accepted. So what did this court find? I've just taken the court ruling from New York directly, and I'll just read it out. So since the LCM DNA method of testing as performed by the OCMA, and that is the New York Laboratory, is basically the same techniques as HCN DNA testing. HCN stands for high copy number, which is the same as conventional DNA profiling, with the exception of its increased amplification cycles. The court finds that the LCM DNA testing as performed by the OCMA is not a novel scientific technique for the purposes of the following inquiry. Indeed, both LCM and HCM forms of DNA testing require the same steps to be taken. Therefore, in addition to the court finding that people have met their burden of establishing that LCM DNA testing as conducted by OCMA is generally accepted as reliable in the forensic science community under the standard enunciated in the FRI. So what this means is the New York court decided that the low copy number method was a valid technique to be used in the court going process, and so this is now allowed within New York. Now this is a very important ruling for us, because one of the points major points which was made in the Omar trial was that the technique wasn't valid because it wasn't being used in the United States. And of course, one point to make, of course, is that it had never been tested in the United States. So one of the issues which is raised, of course, is how can you use a new technique, how can you actually introduce a new technique into court if one of the criteria for its acceptance is general use within the scientific community. Someone has got to be first. Now to summarize, this is the Omar timeline. You see the bombing was in 1998, LCN starts in 2000. In 2007, the Omar trial occurred. There was a 3-week moratorium. After the process then resumes, CADI report reported in 2008. Then we have the Read and Read appeal, which found in favour of low copy number in the London Court of Appeal. And then we have the New York FRI judgment in 2010. So this means officially we've reached the position that there was actually nothing wrong with the evidence presented at Omar by the scientists working for the prosecution. Furthermore, we're now seeing a very rapid acceptance of the method on the worldwide basis, and without doubt the FRI hearing is a very important watershed. Some important comments, I think, from the Read and Read judgment on the question of how do you actually get a new technique into court. This ruling from R.V. Clark says it would be wrong to deny to the law of evidence that advances to be gained from new techniques and new advances in science. It raises the question of whether scientists should act as gatekeepers, as happened in the Omar trial. And there is this other quote here that says, in reaching this decision, the Court of Appeal rejected evidence from Bruce Bedoli, a former senior scientist with the FBI. He told judges that DNA profiles obtained using the LCM method were not of high enough quality to be put before a jury and should only be used to help an investigation. My point here is that to decide whether a technique is fit for purpose is not really the responsibility of the scientist. It's really the responsibility of the court to hear the evidence to decide whether it should be put before a jury. It's not right for scientists to decide whether evidence should or should not be put before a court. An important point made by the prior hearing was they didn't like to make a distinction between the conventional method and the low copy number method. They decided that these techniques are basically the same. And I actually agree with that quite strongly. So that means we shouldn't really be treating all DNA profiles as if they are low copy number. And the reason I say that is because the techniques are becoming ever more sensitive and we should treat them all in the same way. And to do this, the universal methodology to interpret is now required that takes account of all the various ambiguities that are typically associated with the low copy number test. And there's a paper which myself and John Buckleton from ESR wrote last year, just to reinforce the point that this is a view which we've held for some time.
So what about us?
There is a very strong public perception that the presence of the DNA profile means a suspect must be guilty of the crime, but this is, of course, by no means true. The purpose of the scientist really is to explain the various methods by which evidence could be transferred. The scientist is not there to prosecute anyone. The scientist is only there to assist the court. Whether an individual is found guilty or innocent has no bearing on the effectiveness of the science. There is a very strong media effect which plays here as well, I think. Because I think the media actually reinforces the CSI effect, if you like, and reinforces this public perception. And also I've noticed that the bad news is good news as far as the media is concerned. And there is not a lot of reporting when things go well, but when things go bad, you find that there is a lot of media interest in that. I want to turn now to a slightly different area.
This is called the PROM Treaty, MC DNA Exchange Project. MC stands for the European Network of Forensic Science Institutes, and this is a collaboration of laboratories within Europe. And as I said earlier on, the purpose is to expand the utility of databases across the whole of the EU. The MC Group is instrumental in the development of EU policy. It doesn't actually make policy, but the members are very influential, and in practice, the MC recommendations are adopted as EU policy. Forensic science is still maturing. There's been a massive expansion in recent years. And the PROM Treaty encourages data exchange across the EU. To do this, we need common standards, and the mechanism to generate these standards resides within the MC Group. The interpolated markers are used across the EU and beyond, and currently discriminating power is insufficient. Because there are not enough markers in common. And what the MC Group did was to provide a customer specification to improve the discriminating power to facilitate the use of new markers so that we can compare across the entire continent of Europe. Now this diagram here shows the relative discriminating powers. If you look at the bottom axis there, that number there is a number of zeros that you have to put after the number one. So the current Interpol set has one with around about nine zeros after it. The new system, which MC has facilitated, has one with about 16 zeros power.
So what has happened recently
is manufacturers have taken this on board. They've provided new systems which have these, which has this much higher discriminating power. They're now on the market, and laboratories are testing these new kits. There are certainly very big challenges for national DNA databases as they must adapt to this new science. And there's an example of what the new system actually looks like. And these changes have now been enshrined in EU legislation, and I'm just giving a few examples there of the legislation that's appeared. And I do regard this as a notable MC success. The legislation says the intensified exchange of information regarding forensic evidence and the increased use of evidence from one member state in the judicial processes of another highlights the need to establish common standards for forensic service providers. So here we have a call now to try to get common standards across the EU, so they're doing similar things, and at the moment we don't have this. So the next challenge for ANSI is to standardise interpretation methods so that we get more or less the same results regardless of the laboratory that produces the sample. In my view, interpretation is much more important than new biochemistry. It's very difficult to get new interpretation methods introduced, and I think we're about 10 years behind in this respect. Updating the interpretation methodology is the most cost-effective route to increase productivity as far as forensic laboratories are concerned. A lot of cases go unreported, and that's simply because the interpretation methodology can't cope with some of these complex DNA profiles we have to deal with. And finally, EPSIS is involved into an organisation that's able to direct timely changes in science and is able to influence the policy makers, as I've previously showed. There is further to go. There is a tremendous lack of funding for research and development, and the development of common European standards is consequently going to be inhibited, I think, because of the lack of funding. And this means that policy does tend to move faster than the science. So the Prüm Treaty, the desire to move to these very large European databases, needs to be underpinned by funding in order to make sure that the science is up to speed. There's also a desperate need to facilitate education of EU scientists, and I think this is true worldwide, in order to keep up the change, in order to keep up to date with the rapid changes that are currently taking place. Okay, and that's over to Sally Ann.